your secretary's office during most of this period. You were sent to Jerusalem in 1966. Is that a correct description of your position at that time? And what is the background of your move to Jerusalem?
Yes, I was sent to Jerusalem in January 67. When one talk about the Six-Day War in June 67, we have to go back at least to 1966. In 1966, tension rose again in the Middle East. This time, not in the Egypt-Israel sector, which remained perfectly quiet thanks to the presence of UNEF-1, but in the Israel-Syria sector. The relations then between Israel and Syria were governed by the 1949 Mixed General Armistice Agreement. Under the agreement, all violation of the agreement could be brought before the Israel-Syria Mixed Armistice Commission, or ISMAC. They were brought in the form of complaints for one or the other of the two parties. The commission would examine them in the order of their submission, so one by one. The decision of commission was taken by simple majority, but since almost always the two parties would vote in the opposing direction, the decision was in fact taken by the chief of staff, the chairman of the committee, the chief of staff of UNSO or his representative. Now, soon after the establishment of the commission, there were so many complaints that the commission could no longer examine them in the order of their submission, and the commission was completely bogged down. To deal with this problem, it was decided that the most urgent, the most dangerous complaints would be dealt by the committee in the emergency meetings. But soon Israel boycotted these emergency meetings as not conform with the spirit of the armistice agreement. So in fact, since the mid-50s, there were no meetings of ISMAC. The function of ISMAC was when they to have observers observe the general situation and to report when there is any breach of the ceasefire, the armistice. In 1966, there were many incidents in the Israel-Syria sector, mainly because of the disputed lands in the demilitarized zone. At the conclusion of the 49 General Armistice Agreement, the Syrian soldiers occupied one pocket in Galilee, in the Israeli territory, Israeli-controlled territory. So by agreement, they agreed to withdraw, but that area was made into a demilitarized zone in which the Israel was prohibited of maintaining troops, but they could maintain some security police. That area, the land belonged, all the land belonged to the Arabs. But slowly, after 1949, the Israelis bought land, as much land as they could, through various devices. For instance, by creating a company in Iran, and the Iranian company would buy the land, then turn it to the Israelis. And also when they got the land, they would prevent the Arab farmers from coming near, and even harass the Arab farmers, to force the Arab farmers to sell their land. But there were, in 1966, quite a number of disputed land claimed both by Arabs and Israelis. The Arab farmers could not get into the land because they were prevented from doing so by the Israeli security police. When the Israeli farmers went into the land to till it, the Syrian soldiers positioned on the Golan Heights would fire at them. Then the Syrian shelling would be invariably followed by air attack by Israeli warplanes at the positions or even the nearby village, Syrian villages. In 1966, there were many of those incidents, and the situation became obviously dangerous. In January 1967, the then Secretary General, Houtan, issued an appeal to both sides for restraint. He proposed that the two parties try to settle their differences on the disputed land in what he called the special emergency meetings of ISMAC. He gave the title of special emergency meetings since normal meeting could be held and Israel had already boycotted the emergency meetings. Syria immediately accepted. A few days later, under the pressure from the United States, Israel also agreed. So the first meeting took place around mid-January, but they couldn't agree on the agenda. The second meeting was scheduled for the end of January. In the meanwhile, the principal political advisor to the chief of staff, who was chairing the meeting, was sick. The principal political advisor was Henri Vigée. He was 80 years old. He was an old member of the League of Nations, and he was the deputy to Bunch in the negotiation in Rhodes, which led to the conclusion of the 1949 mixed general armistice agreement. When someone 80-year-old has pneumonia, it becomes very dangerous. And he was completely incapacitated, and Bunch sent me there to replace him. This is how I went to Jerusalem in January 1967. Soon, one day after my arrival, we have that second meeting. Then I realized that the two parties were hopelessly split on the question of the agenda. Apparently, at the beginning of the first meeting, the Syrian delegate made a speech in which he said that Syria wanted peace. So the Israelis seized this to propose that the special emergency meetings should discuss not only the disputed land, the specific problem of disputed land in the demilitarized zone, but also the broader question of peace between the two countries. Syria adamantly opposed. They didn't want to talk about peace with Israel. They wanted to discuss the specific problem of disputed land in the military zone and only that problem. So the second meeting was also inconclusive. We scheduled the third meeting for the beginning of February. But before the meeting could take place, the Syria sent word to say that they would not attend. So we spent the whole month of February, March, and the beginning of April to try to persuade Syria to come back to the Mixed Armistice Commission, but to no avail. But the situation at that time was quite the spring was late in coming during that year, so the weather is too inclement for sowing. But on the 7th of April, the weather was better, and the Israelis sent two tractors into the disputed land. Immediately, the soldiers on the Golan Heights, the Syrian soldiers on the Golan Heights, fired at them. And that was followed by air attacks by Israeli warplane against the Syrian position on the Golan Heights, many villages. And some Israeli plane went even over Damascus. There was a dogfight over Damascus in which six Syrian MiGs was down. There were no Israeli losses. We immediately reported the incident to the Secretary General. And in fact, I drafted the cable and I said that the incident created a new dangerous situation which could lead to war. So from that day on, Syria immediately approached President Nasser. For many years, the Syrians had accused Nasser of shielding himself behind UNEF-1 and not participating in the common struggle against Israel. But this time, with this very serious incident, Nasser acceded to the Syrian request. The tension arose very rapidly. Both sides, there were troop movement on both sides. A joint command was created on the Arab side, a joint command of Egyptian, Syria, and Jordanian troops, led by an Egyptian general. And there were cries of holy war in the neighboring Arab lands everywhere.
Now, you mentioned there the fact that there were troop movements at the time. I wanted to ask about UNSO, and that is the military observers, because they were able to move along the borders between Israel and Syria at that time, as well as in the south, of course, there was UNEF. They followed, or did they follow closely, the movement of Israeli troops at that point?
Yes, we followed. There were troops movement, but according to the General Armistice Agreement, you have military troops along the border, along certain zone, but beyond that zone, we have no control.
Mm-hmm.
They can deploy their troops and so on. And the Israelis, in fact, the deployment troops were visible mainly on the Arab side, where troops, heavy artillery were positioned beyond the zone of limitation of armament. But there were many. But in the Israeli side, it's much less tangible, because the Israelis got a different system. In fact, they can deploy, they can call troops, called reservists, by, I think, a secret signal through the video, and they can do that very quickly. So the movement troops were more visible on the Arab side, and particularly in the Sinai, when Nasser started to mass quite a very large number of troops.
Now, it has been said, well, I think it's now known, that the Soviet Union passed information to the Egyptians, both in Moscow, in fact to Mr. Sadat, who happened to have been in Moscow at that time, and to Nasser in Cairo, that the Israelis were massing troops on the Syrian border, evidently intending an invasion of Syria. The UN military observers did not confirm that, is that correct?
That's right, you see. Now, as I said, you have a limitation of armament in the border area. Beyond that, of course, they can have any number of troops. The UN responsibility is to check that the provisions of the General Armistice Agreements are respected. When that claim, that complaint was aired, the Chief of Staff of UNSO, as in his right, has asked Israel to admit the military observers to check in that area. That the area at the border where the limitation of armament applied, there were no excessive deployment. And we could not check on the area beyond. But we did check in a special inspection according to the procedure well defined by the standing operating procedure of UNSO. And we said that there was no excessive deployment and armament.
And that was reported to New York?
To not only to the Secretary General, but the Secretary General made it public.
Right.
As a mean of lessening tension, you see. But the tension continued, naturally, nevertheless. Then, on the evening of 16 May 1967, General Ricci, the commander of UNIF-1, received a message from the Egyptian local commander asking Ricci to withdraw the UN troops from two positions. And that was the start of the crisis.
Right. Now, being in Jerusalem at the time, how did the UNSO office interpret this this Egyptian move?
Well, it was, we interpreted, we took it very seriously, very, very seriously. In fact, we were the first to knew the crisis because all the cables went through Jerusalem. We were a relay center, you see. So it went to, and we told the Secretary General, of course, we were here to, we would do anything he instructed us to do. But the next day, the Secretary General sent the cables to Ricci, to General Ricci, and to General Gould in UNSO, saying that they are going to handle the matter in New York, at headquarters, at New York headquarters.
So that the advice of from Jerusalem was not requested then by the Secretary General on what to
no,
do?
No. So we just followed. We followed the very tense negotiation, which lasted 2 days, you see, from the evening of the 16th until the 18th, when the Egyptian government, President Nasser, formally submitted the request for the withdrawal of UNIF-1, and Houthan decided to accede to the request. All this period that you have many events during this 48 hours, that was in New York. But of course we knew it, you see, because we were kept informed.
Now, this this initial Egyptian message has been interpreted various ways, but as you say, it only asked for the withdrawal of UNIF soldiers from the observation post.
Two positions.
Which would, what would have been the result if that had, if simply that had been done and nothing more? What would the result have been for UNIF-1?
Well, if it's nothing more, I think the crisis could be contained. But there was no assurance there would be nothing more. And also, during that 48 crucial hours, the Egyptian army had already pushed our soldiers from the position, and also they were trying to push our position from Sharm el-Sheikh, and that is very important because Sharm el-Sheikh controlled the access to the Gulf of Aqaba.
I wanted to ask that specific point. How important was that post in terms of maintaining freedom of access to the Gulf of Aqaba?
Essential. Essential. Because the Gulf of Aqaba, the Strait of Tiran, is very narrow. And it can be controlled only from the Sinai side. From the Saudi Arabian side, you can't because of the configuration of the coast. There, a small position could close completely the Strait of Tiran. And that's why in 1957, Dag Hammarskjöld was so keen on getting the control of that part, because that was essential for his plan for peace. But naturally, we didn't know on the evening of 16 May what was the whole intention of Egypt, except that it was a big crisis.
Now, had UNSO made any assessment of the relative military strengths at this time, given the likelihood of war?
The military strengths, we don't have the exact knowledge, but we know, more or less, that Egypt seemed very strong. It has massed in the Sinai close to 100,000 troops there, with tanks and so on. As you know, quite recently, the war in Yemen was ended, and therefore Egypt withdrew their troops, the troops they sent to Yemen, to back in the Cairo area, and they have positions, send a lot of these troops into the Sinai with many tanks. I think that Israel's forces are always very strong and extremely efficient. Syria's got, the air force are not as strong as now, see, they later on this trend. The Syria is less of a factor. The Jordanians' force have lost much of its power since the departure of Ghalib Pasha. So I think the Jordanian was not a big major factor.
So actually the UN observers then were as surprised as many others by the total defeat of the Egyptian army so quickly.
Yes, well, that was, I think, a surprise not only to the UN, but to many people. Now, the defeat of the Egyptian army is mainly the defeat of the Air Force. The destruction of the Air Force during the first 12 hours.
Yes, it clearly illustrated the importance of air power in
yes.
At that point. Now, how long did you stay in Jerusalem?
Well, I was sent there really for 2 months, but because of the tension, I was asked to stay on, and I stayed until I arranged for the ceasefire operation in the Golan Heights. Then I went back to New York.
So you were still in Jerusalem at the time when Resolution 242 was being drafted in New York. Continue there for a moment on the 67, the outcome of the 67 war, you were still in Jerusalem then when the Egyptian army collapsed. What did UNSO do at that point, where clearly a new military situation had been created in the area?
Yeah. Well, you see, as I said, during the very tense period from 16 to 18 May, the negotiations, the efforts of the secretariats were made by the Secretary General and Ralph Bunche at UN headquarters. We were told that not to do anything, in fact, So we just follow the events. But when on the 18th May, Hutin acceded to the request of Nasser and ordered the withdrawal of the UN troops, we tried to be helpful. When UNF-1 was deployed along the border between Egypt and Israel, we still maintain a small group of observers in Gaza. Israel had denounced the general armistice agreement between Israel and Egypt and no longer recognized the Mixed Armistice Commission. But Hutin's position was that the general armistice agreement was concluded by two parties. And the agreement can be ended from the UN viewpoint only if both parties so decide, or if the Security Council so decide. Since Egypt insisted on the maintenance of the agreement and the matter was not decided by the Security Council, we decided to maintain the Mixed Armies Commission
in Gaza,
in Egyptian territory and with only the Egyptian members. And therefore, it was a symbolic presence and we maintained a token presence of 6 observers there. And the observers also had a periodic patrol along the border. All that is symbolic. But now it became useful because we said if UNF-1 should be withdrawn, if the UN soldiers should be withdrawn, then I think the same function, but more less intensely, could be performed by the military observers. So we could, in that way, still have a UN presence. So Egypt has always agreed on the presence of the observers, but we have to deal with the Israeli government. We went to the Israeli government and we told them that peace is important. The withdrawal of UNF doesn't mean war. We have to maintain peace at all costs. So we should have the presence of the UN. For that purpose, we propose to increase the number of observers in Gaza from 6 to 20 as a first step. The Israeli agreed. They said we continue not to recognize the commission, but we will cooperate with you. So with their cooperation, the military observers were sent from Jerusalem to Gaza through the Israeli checkpoint.
Now, were they limited to the Gaza area, or could they go across into the Sinai?
It's in the Gaza, but I think the presence is useful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think we have not considered going to Sinai because with 20 observers, we can't do very much.
Right.
What we want is a presence made as visible as possible, so we increase the patrolling and so on. So with this, the UNF, the UNSO presence was increased and became more active. Mm-hmm. And during our meeting with the Israeli Director General, he also said that Israel would exercise restraint and would, to the extent possible, prevent a war. But they also said that, however, there are two matters which we would consider as casus belli. One is an increase of terrorist activities by the Palestinians from Gaza. And secondly, and more importantly, the Gulf of Aqaba should not be closed to Israel shipping.
No.
So we immediately cabled this to the Secretary General. And I think that is this message which caused the Secretary General to ask and obtain a visit to Cairo on 22 May. He was to visit Cairo much later, but he advanced the date in order to get Nasser not to close the Gulf of Aqaba. And we received a cable from the Secretary General asking us and General Rickey to go to Cairo to meet him. So on the 21st, on the 21st of May, we were there waiting for him. But during the night of 21st to 22nd of May, while the Secretary General was still in London, he stopped over in London on his way to Cairo, President Nasser, visiting Sinai, proclaimed the closure of the Gulf of Aqaba to Israel ship. And that sealed the fate. So when Houtan came, he immediately saw Nasser and asked him, why did you do it? I came here to ask you, to beg you, not to close it, but this is war. And Nasser said, I didn't want to say no to you, therefore I did it before you arrived.
Now, were you there at Cairo when
Yes, in fact, he called me and he said, what do we do, and so on, and then we decided to make an appeal. In fact, he called it a moratorium, not to, because we knew that, in fact, we knew that after the closure, it's a matter of days. But therefore, in the last effort, he wanted to make an appeal.
Yes, I've seen this reference to the appeal for a moratorium.